Myself? Never used it before. Not of kin. Sounds like hillbilly talk. Not of a kind. Same root. Kindness, too. They can't have real kindness toward him. They're not his kin. That's exactly the feeling. Old word, so ancient, it's almost drowned out. What a change through the centuries. Now anybody can be kind. And everybody's supposed to be. Except that long ago it was something you were born into and couldn't help. Now it's just a faked-up attitude half the time, like teachers the first day of class. But what do they really know about kindness, who are not kin? It goes over and over again through my thoughts. Mein Kind, my child. There it is in another language. Mein Kinder. Bereitet so spät durch Nacht und Wind, es ist der Vater mit seinem Kind. Strange feeling from that. What are you thinking about? Sylvia asks. An old poem by Goethe. It must be 200 years old. I had to learn it a long time ago. I don't know why I should remember it now, except... The strange feeling comes back. How does it go? Sylvia asks. I try to recall. A man is riding along a beach at night through the wind. It's a father with his son, whom he holds fast in his arm. He asks his son why he looks so pale, and the son replies, "Father, don't you see the ghost?" The father tried to reassure the boy it's only a bank of fog along the beach that he sees, and only the rustling of the leaves in the wind that he hears. But the son keeps saying it is the ghost, and the father rides harder and harder through the night. How does it end? In failure. Death of the child. The ghost wins. The wind blows light up from the coals, and I see Sylvia look at me, startled. "Well, that's another land and another time," I say. "Here life is the end, and ghosts have no meaning. I believe that." "I believe in all this, too," I say, looking out at the darkened prairie, although I'm not sure of what it all means yet. I'm not sure of much of anything these days. Maybe that's why I talk so much. The coals die lower and lower. We smoke our last cigarettes. Chris is off somewhere in the darkness, but I'm not going to shag after him. John is carefully silent, and Sylvia is silent. And suddenly, we are all separate. All alone in our private universes. And there is no communication among us. We douse the fire and go back to the sleeping bags in the pines. I discover that this one tiny refuge of scrub pines, where I have put the sleeping bags, is also the refuge from the wind of millions of mosquitoes up from the reservoir. The mosquito repellent doesn't stop them at all. I crawl deep into the sleeping bag and make one little hole for breathing. I'm almost asleep when Chris finally shows up. "There's a big sand pile over there," he says, crunching around on the pine needles. "Yes," I say. "Get to sleep." "You should see it." "Will you come and see it tomorrow?" "We won't have time." "Can I play over there tomorrow morning?" "Yes." He makes interminable noises getting undressed and into the sleeping bag. He is in it. Then he rolls around. Then he is silent, and then rolls some more. Then he says, "Dad?"
"What?"
"What was it like when you were a kid?" "Go to sleep, Chris. There are limits to what you can listen to." Later I hear a sharp inhaling of phlegm that tells me he has been crying, and though I'm exhausted, I don't sleep. A few words of consolation might have helped there. He was trying to be friendly, but the words weren't forthcoming for some reason. Consoling words are more for strangers, for hospitals, not kin. Little emotional band-aids like that aren't what he needs, or what's sought. I don't know what he needs or what's sought. A gibbous moon comes up from the horizon beyond the pines, and by its slow, patient arc across the sky, I measure hour after hour of semi-sleep. Too much fatigue. The moon and strange dreams and sounds of mosquitoes and odd fragments of memory become jumbled and mixed in an unreal lost landscape in which the moon is shining and yet there is a bank of fog, and I am riding a horse, and Chris is with me, and the horse jumps over a small stream that runs through the sand toward the ocean somewhere beyond. And then that is broken, and then it reappears. And in the fog there appears an intimation of a figure. It disappears when I look at it directly, but then reappears in the corner of my vision when I turn my glance. I am about to say something, to call to it, to recognize it, but then do not, knowing that to recognize it by any gesture or action is to give it a reality which it must not have. But it is a figure I recognize, even though I do not let on. It is Phaedrus, evil spirit, insane, from a world without life or death. The figure fades, and I hold panic down, tight, not rushing it, just letting it sink in, not believing it, not disbelieving it. But the hair crawls slowly on the back of my skull. He is calling Chris, is that it? Yes? Chapter 6. My watch says 9 o'clock, and it's already too hot to sleep. Outside the sleeping bag, the sun is already high into the sky. The air around is clear and dry. I get up puffy-eyed and arthritic from the ground. My mouth is already dry and cracked, and my face and hands are covered with mosquito bites. Some sunburn from yesterday morning is hurting. Beyond the pines are burned grass and clumps of earth and sand so bright they are hard to look at. The heat, silence, and barren hills and blank sky give a feeling of great, intense space. Not a bit of moisture in the sky. Today's going to be a scorcher. I walk out of the pines onto a stretch of barren sand between some grass and watch for a long time, meditatively. I've decided today's Chautauqua will begin to explore Phaedrus's world. It was intended earlier simply to restate some of his ideas that relate to technology and human values, and make no reference to him personally, but the pattern of thought and memory that occurred last night has indicated this is not the way to go. To omit him now would be to run from something that should not be run from. In the first gray of the morning, what Chris said about his Indian friend's grandmother came back to me, clearing something up. She said ghosts appear when someone has not been buried right. That's true. He never was buried right, and that's exactly the source of the trouble. Later I turn and see John is up and looking at me, uncomprehendingly. He is still not really awake, and now walks aimlessly in circles to clear his head. Soon Sylvia is up too, and her left eye is all puffed up. I ask her what happened. She says it is from mosquito bites. I begin to collect gear to repack the cycle. John does the same. When this is done, we get a fire started while Sylvia opens up packages of bacon and eggs and bread for breakfast. When the food is ready, I go over and wake Chris. He doesn't want to get up. I tell him again. He says no. I grab the bottom of the sleeping bag, give it a mighty tablecloth jerk, and he is out of it, blinking in the pine needles. It takes him a while to figure out what has happened, while I roll up the sleeping bag. He comes to breakfast looking insulted, eats one bite, says he isn't hungry, his stomach hurts. I point to the lake down below us, so strange in the middle of the semi-desert, but he doesn't show any interest. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig, continued. Cassette 2, Side 2. He comes to breakfast, looking insulted, eats one bite, says he isn't hungry, his stomach hurts. I point to the lake down below us, so strange in the middle of the semi-desert, but he doesn't show any interest. He repeats his complaint. I just let it go by, and John and Sylvia disregard it too. I'm glad they were told what the situation is with him. It might have created real friction otherwise. We finish breakfast silently, and I'm oddly tranquil. The decision about Phaedrus may have something to do with it. But we are also perhaps 100 feet above the reservoir, looking across it into a kind of western spaciousness. Barren hills, no one anywhere, not a sound. And there is something about places like this that raises your spirits a little
and makes you think that things will probably get better.
While loading the remaining gear on the luggage rack, I see with surprise that the rear tire is worn way down. All that speed and heavy load and heat on the road yesterday must have caused it. The chain is also saggy, and I get out the tools to adjust it, and then groan.
"What's the matter?" John says.
"Threads stripped in the chain adjustment." I remove the adjusting bolt and examine the threads. "It's my own fault for trying to adjust at once without loosening the axle nut. The bolt is good." I show it to him. "It looks like the internal threading in the frame that's stripped." John stares at the wheel for a long time.
"Think you can make it into town?"
"Oh yeah, sure. You can run it forever. It just makes the chain difficult to adjust." He watches carefully as I take up the rear axle nut until it's barely snug, tap it sideways with a hammer until the chain slack is right, then tighten up the axle nut with all my might to keep the axle from slipping forward later on, and replace the cotter pin. Unlike the axle nuts on a car, this one doesn't affect bearing tightness.
"How do you know how to do that?"
he asks. "You just have to figure it out."
"I wouldn't know where to start," he says.
I think to myself, that's the problem, all right. Where to start? To reach him, you have to back up and back up, and the further back you go, the further back you see you have to go, until what looked like a small problem of communication turns into a major philosophic inquiry. That, I suppose, is why the Chautauqua. I repack the toolkit and close the side cover plates and think to myself, he's worth reaching, though. On the road again, the dry air cools off the slight sweat from that chain job, and I'm feeling good for a while. As soon as the sweat dries off, though, it's hot. Must be in the 80s already. There's no traffic on this road, and we're moving right along. It's a traveling day. Now I want to begin to fulfill a certain obligation by stating that there was one person, no longer here, who had something to say and who said it, but whom no one believed or really understood. Forgotten. For reasons that will become apparent, I prefer that he remain forgotten, but there's no choice other than to reopen his case. I don't know his whole story. No one ever will, except Phaedrus himself, and he can no longer speak. But from his writings, and from what others have said, and from fragments of my own recall, it should be possible to piece together some kind of approximation of what he was talking about. Since the basic ideas for this Chautauqua were taken from him, there will be no real deviation, only an enlargement that may make the Chautauqua more understandable than if it were presented in a purely abstract way. The purpose of the enlargement is not to argue for him, certainly not to praise him. The purpose is to bury him forever. Back in Minnesota, when we were traveling through some marshland, I did some talking about the shapes of technology, the death force that the Sutherlands seem to be running from. I want to move now in the opposite direction from the Sutherlands, toward that force and into its center. In doing so, we will be entering Phaedrus's world, the only world he ever knew, in which all understanding is in terms of underlying form. The world of underlying form is an unusual object of discussion because it is actually a mode of discussion itself. You discuss things in terms of their immediate appearance, or you discuss them in terms of their underlying form. And when you try to discuss these modes of discussion, you get involved in what could be called a platform problem. You have no platform from which to discuss them other than the modes themselves. Previously, I was discussing his world of underlying form, or at least the aspect of it called technology, from an external view. Now I think it's right to talk about that world of underlying form from its own point of view. I want to talk about the underlying form of the world of underlying form itself. To do this, first of all, a dichotomy is necessary. But before I can use it honestly, I have to back up and say what it is and means, and that is a long story in itself. Part of this backup problem.
But right now, I just want to use a dichotomy and explain it later. I want to divide human understanding into two kinds, classical understanding and romantic understanding. In terms of ultimate truth, a dichotomy of this sort has little meaning, but it is quite legitimate when one is operating within the classic mode, used to discover or create a world of underlying form. The terms classic and romantic, as Phaedrus used them, mean the following. A classical understanding sees the world primarily as underlying form itself. A romantic understanding sees it primarily in terms of immediate appearance. If you were to show an engine or a mechanical drawing or electronic schematic to a romantic, it is unlikely he would see much of interest in it. It has no appeal because the reality he sees is its surface. Dull, complex lists of names, lines, and numbers. Nothing interesting. But if you were to show the same blueprint or schematic, or give the same description to a classical person, he might look at it and then become fascinated by it because he sees that within the lines and shapes and symbols is a tremendous richness of underlying form. The romantic mode is primarily inspirational, imaginative, creative, intuitive. Feelings rather than facts predominate. Art, when it is opposed to science, is often romantic. It does not proceed by reason or by laws. It proceeds by feeling, intuition, and aesthetic conscience. In the Northern European cultures, the romantic mode is usually associated with femininity, but this is certainly not a necessary association. The classic mode, by contrast, proceeds by reason and by laws, which are themselves underlying forms of thought and behavior. In the European cultures, it is primarily a masculine mode, and the fields of science, law, and medicine are unattractive to women largely for this reason. Although motorcycle riding is romantic, motorcycle maintenance is purely classic. The dirt, the grease, the mastery of underlying form required all give it such a negative romantic appeal that women never go near it. Although surface ugliness is often found in the classic mode of understanding, it is not inherent in it. There is a classical aesthetic which romantics often miss because of its subtlety. The classic style is straightforward, unadorned, unemotional, economical, and carefully proportioned. Its purpose is not to inspire emotionally, but to bring order out of chaos and make the unknown known. It is not an aesthetically free and natural style. It is aesthetically restrained. Everything is under control. Its value is measured in terms of the skill with which this control is maintained. To a romantic, this classic mode often appears dull, awkward, and ugly, like mechanical maintenance itself. Everything is in terms of pieces and parts and components and relationships. Nothing is figured out until it is run through the computer a dozen times. Everything's got to be measured and proved. Oppressive, heavy, endlessly gray, the death force. Within the classic mode, however, the romantic has some appearances of his own. Frivolous, irrational, erratic, untrustworthy, interested primarily in pleasure-seeking, shallow, of no substance, often a parasite who cannot or will not carry his own weight. A real drag on society. By now, these battle lines should sound a little familiar. This is the source of the trouble. Persons tend to think and feel exclusively in one mode or the other, and in doing so, to misunderstand and underestimate what the other mode is all about. But no one is willing to give up the truth as he sees it, and as far as I know, no one now living has any real reconciliation of these truths or modes. There is no point at which these visions of reality are unified. And so, in recent times, we have seen a huge split develop between a classic culture and a romantic counterculture. Two worlds, growingly alienated and hateful toward each other, with everyone wondering if it will always be this way, a house divided against itself. No one wants it, really, despite what his antagonists in the other dimension might think. It is within this context that what Phaedrus thought and said is significant. But no one was listening at that time, and they only thought him eccentric at first, then undesirable, then slightly mad, and then genuinely insane. There seems little doubt that he was insane, but much of his writing at the time indicates that what was driving him insane was this hostile opinion of him. Unusual behavior tends to produce estrangement in others, which tends to further the unusual behavior, and thus the estrangement, in self-stroking cycles until some sort of climax is reached. In Phaedrus's case, there was a court-ordered police arrest and permanent removal from society. I see we are at the left turn onto US 12, and John is pulled up for gas. I pull up beside him. The thermometer by the door of the station reads 92 degrees. Going to be another rough one today, I say. When the tanks are filled, we head across the street into a restaurant for coffee. Chris, of course, is hungry. I tell him I've been waiting for that. I tell him he eats with the rest of us or not at all. Not angrily, just matter-of-factly. He's reproachful, but sees how it's going to be. I catch a fleeting look of relief from Sylvia. Evidently, she thought this was going to be a continuous problem. When we have finished the coffee and are outside again, the heat is so ferocious, we move off on the cycles as fast as possible. Again, there is that momentary coolness, but it disappears. The sun makes the burned grass and sand so bright I have to squint to cut down glare. This US 12 is an old, bad highway. The broken concrete is tar-patched and bumpy. Road signs indicate detours ahead. On either side of the road are occasional worn sheds and shacks and roadside stands that have accumulated through the years. The traffic is heavy now.
I'm just as happy to be thinking about the rational, analytical, classical world of Phaedrus.
His kind of rationality has been used since antiquity to remove oneself from the tedium and depression of one's immediate surroundings. What makes it hard to see is that where once it was used to get away from it all, the escape has been so successful that now it is the it-all that the romantics are trying to escape. What makes his world so hard to see clearly is not its strangeness, but its usualness. Familiarity can blind you, too. His way of looking at things produces a kind of description that can be called an analytic description. That is another name of the classic platform from which one discusses things in terms of their underlying form. He was a totally classic person. And to give a fuller description of what this is, I want now to turn his analytic approach back upon itself, to analyze analysis itself. I want to do this, first of all, by giving an extensive example of it, and then by dissecting what it is. The motorcycle is a perfect subject for it, since the motorcycle itself was invented by classic minds. So listen. A motorcycle may be divided for purposes of classical rational analysis by means of its component assemblies and by means of its functions. If divided by means of its component assemblies, its most basic division is into a power assembly and a running assembly. The power assembly may be divided into the engine and the power delivery system. The engines will be taken up first. The engine consists of a housing containing a powertrain, a fuel-air system, an ignition system, a feedback system, and a lubrication system. The powertrain consists of cylinders, pistons, connecting rods, a crankshaft, and a flywheel. The fuel-air system components, which are part of the engine, consist of a gas tank and filter, an air cleaner, a carburetor, valves, and exhaust pipes. The ignition system consists of an alternator, a rectifier, a battery, a high-voltage coil, and spark plugs. The feedback system consists of a cam chain, a camshaft, tappets, and a distributor. The lubrication system consists of an oil pump and channels throughout the housing for distribution of the oil. The power delivery system accompanying the engine consists of a clutch, a transmission, and a chain. The supporting assembly accompanying the power assembly consists of a frame, including foot pegs, seat and fenders, a steering assembly, front and rear shock absorbers, wheels, control levers and cables, lights and horn, and speed and mileage indicators. That's a motorcycle, divided according to its components. To know what the components are for, a division according to functions is necessary. A motorcycle may be divided into normal running functions and special operator-controlled functions. Normal running functions may be divided into functions during the intake cycle, functions during the compression cycle, functions during the power cycle, and functions during the exhaust cycle, and so on. I could go on about which functions occur in their proper sequence during each of the four cycles, then go on to the operator-controlled functions, and that would be a very summary description of the underlying form of a motorcycle. It would be extremely short and rudimentary, as descriptions of this sort go. Almost any one of the components mentioned can be expanded on indefinitely. I've read an entire engineering volume on contact points alone, which are just a small but vital part of the distributor. There are other types of engines than the single-cylinder auto engine described here, two-cycle engines, multi-cylinder engines, diesel engines, Wankel engines, but this example is enough. This description would cover the what of the motorcycle in terms of components and the how of the engine in terms of functions. It would badly need a where analysis in the form of an illustration, and also a why analysis in the form of engineering principles that led to this particular conformation of parts. But the purpose here isn't exhaustively to analyze the motorcycle. It's to provide a starting point, an example of a mode of understanding of things which will itself become an object of analysis. There's certainly nothing strange about this description at first hearing. It sounds like something from a beginning textbook on the subject, or perhaps a first lesson in a vocational course. What is unusual about it is seen when it ceases to be a mode of discourse and becomes an object of discourse. Then certain things can be pointed to. The first thing to be observed about this description is so obvious you have to hold it down, or it will drown out every other observation. This is, it is just duller than ditch water. Yada, 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 ya, carburetor, gear ratio, compression, yada, ya, piston, plugs, intake, yada, ya, on and on and on. That is the romantic face of the classical mode. Dull, awkward, and ugly. Few romantics get beyond that point. But if you can hold down that most obvious observation, some other things can be noticed that do not at first appear. The first is that the motorcycle, so described, is almost impossible to understand unless you already know how one works. The immediate surface impressions that are essential for primary understanding are gone. Only the underlying form is left. The second is that the observer is missing. The description doesn't say that to see the piston you must remove the cylinder head. You aren't anywhere in the picture. Even the operator is a kind of personality-less robot whose performance of a function on the machine is completely mechanical. There are no real subjects in this description. Only objects exist that are independent of any observer. The third is that the words good and bad and all their synonyms are completely absent. No value judgments have been expressed anywhere, only facts. The fourth is that there is a knife moving here, a very deadly one. An intellectual scalpel, so swift and so sharp, you sometimes don't see it moving. You get the illusion that all those parts are just there and are being named as they exist. But they can be named quite differently and organized quite differently, depending on how the knife moves. For example, the feedback mechanism, which includes the camshaft and cam chain and tappets and distributor, exists only because of an unusual cut of this analytical knife. If you were to go to a motorcycle parts department and ask them for a feedback assembly, they wouldn't know what the hell you were talking about. They don't split it up that way. No two manufacturers ever split it up quite the same way, and every mechanic is familiar with the problem of the part you can't buy because you can't find it because the manufacturer considers it a part of something else. It is important to see this knife for what it is, and not to be fooled into thinking that motorcycles, or anything else, are the way they are just because the knife happened to cut it up that way. It is important to concentrate on the knife itself. Later I will want to show how an ability to use this knife creatively and effectively can result in solutions to the classic and romantic split.
Phaedrus was a master with this knife, and used it with dexterity and a sense of power. With a single stroke of analytical thought, he split the whole world into parts of his own choosing. Split the parts, and split the fragments of the parts, finer and finer and finer, until he had reduced it to what he wanted it to be. Even the special use of the terms classic and romantic are examples of his knifemanship. But if this were all there were to him, analytic skill, I would be more than willing to shut up about him. What makes it important not to shut up about him was that he used this skill in such a bizarre and yet meaningful way. No one ever saw this. I don't think he even saw it himself. And it may be an illusion of my own, but the knife he used was less that of an assassin than that of a poor surgeon. Perhaps there is no difference. But he saw a sick and ailing thing happening, and he started cutting deep, deeper and deeper, to get at the root of it. He was after something. That is important. He was after something, and he used the knife because that was the only tool he had. But he took on so much and went so far, in the end his real victim was himself. Chapter 7. Heat is everywhere now. I can't ignore it anymore. The air is like a furnace blast so hot that my eyes and the goggles feel cool compared to the rest of my face. My hands are cool, but the gloves have big black spots from perspiration on the back, surrounded by white streaks of dried salt. On the road ahead, a crow tugs on some carrion and flies up slowly as we approach. It looks like a lizard on the road, dry and stuck to the tar. On the horizon appears an image of buildings, shimmering slightly. I look down at the map and figure it must be Bowman. I think about ice water and air conditioning. On the street and sidewalks of Bowman, we see almost no one, even though plenty of parked cars show they're here. All inside. We swing the machines into an angled parking place with a tight turn that points them outward for when we're ready to go. A lone, elderly person wearing a broad-brimmed hat watches us put the cycles on their stands and remove helmets and goggles. "Hot enough for you?" he asks. His expression is blank. John shakes his head and says, "God!" The expression, shaded by the hat, becomes almost a smile. "What is the temperature?" John asks. 102, he says. "Last I saw. Should go to 104. He asks how far we have come, and we tell him, and he nods with a kind of approval. "That's a long way," he says. Then he asks about the machines. The beer and air conditioning are calling, but we don't break away. We just stand there in the 102 sun, talking to this person. He is a stockman, retired, says this is pretty much ranch country around here, and he used to own a Henderson cycle years ago. It pleases me that he should want to talk about his Henderson in this 102 sun. We talk about it for a while, with growing impatience from John and Sylvia and Chris, and when we finally say goodbye, he says he is glad to have met us, and his expression is still blank, but we sense that he really meant it. He walks away with a kind of slow dignity in the 102 sun. In the restaurant, I try to comment on this, but no one is interested. John and Sylvia look really out of it. They just sit and soak up the air-conditioned air without a move. The waitress comes for the order, and that snaps them out of it a little. But they are not ready, and so she goes away again.
"I don't think I want to leave here," Sylvia says.
An image of the elderly man outside in the wide-brimmed hat comes back to me. "Think what it was like around here before air conditioning," I say. "I am," she says. With the roads this hot, and that bad back tire of mine, we shouldn't go more than 60, I say. No comment from them. Chris, in contrast to them, seems to be back to his normal self, alert and watching everything. When the food comes, he wolfs it down, and then, before we are half finished, asks for more. He gets it, and we wait for him to finish. Miles later, and the heat is just ferocious. Sunglasses and goggles are not enough for this glare. You need a welder's mask. The high plains break up into washed out and gullied hills. It is all bright, whitish tan. Not a blade of grass anywhere. Just scattered weed stalks and rocks and sand. The black of the highway is a relief to look at, so I stare down at it and study how the blur whizzes by underfoot. Beside it, I see the left exhaust pipe has picked up a bluer color than it has ever had before. I spit on my glove tips, touch it, and can see the sizzle. Not good. It's important now to just live with this and not fight it mentally. Mind control. I should talk now about Phaedrus's knife. It'll help understand some of the things we talked about. The application of this knife, the division of the world into parts, and the building of this structure is something everybody does. All the time we are aware of millions of things around us. These changing shapes, these burning hills, the sound of the engine, the feel of the throttle, each rock and weed and fence post and piece of debris beside the road. Aware of these things, but not really conscious of them, unless there is something unusual, or unless they reflect something we are predisposed to see. We could not possibly be conscious of these things and remember all of them because our mind would be so full of useless details, we would be unable to think. From all this awareness, we must select. And what we select and call consciousness is never the same as the awareness, because the process of selection mutates it. We take a handful of sand from the endless landscape of awareness around us, and call that handful of sand the world. Once we have the handful of sand, the world of which we are conscious, a process of discrimination goes to work on it. This is the knife. We divide the sand into parts, this and that, here and there, black and white, now and then. The discrimination is the division of the conscious universe into parts. The handful of sand looks uniform at first, but the longer we look at it, the more diverse we find it to be. Each grain of sand is different. No two are alike. Some are similar in one way, some are similar in another way, and we can form the sand into separate piles on the basis of this similarity and dissimilarity. Shades of color in different piles, sizes in different piles, grain shapes in different piles, subtypes of grain shapes in different piles, grades of opacity in different piles, and so on and on and on. You'd think the process of subdivision and classification would come to an end somewhere, but it doesn't. It just goes on and on. Classical understanding is concerned with the piles and the basis for sorting and interrelating them. Romantic understanding is directed toward the handful of sand before the sorting begins. Both are valid ways of looking at the world, although irreconcilable with each other. What has become an urgent necessity is a way of looking at the world that does violence to neither of these two kinds of understanding and unites them into one. Such an understanding will not reject sand sorting or contemplation of unsorted sand for its own sake. Such an understanding will instead seek to direct attention to the endless landscape from which the sand is taken. That is what Phaedrus, the poor surgeon, was trying to do. To understand what he was trying to do, it's necessary to see that part of the landscape, inseparable from it, which must be understood, is a figure in the middle of it, sorting sand into piles. To see the landscape without seeing this figure is not to see the landscape at all. To reject that part of the Buddha that attends to the analysis of motorcycles is to miss the Buddha entirely. There is a perennial classical question that asks, which part of the motorcycle, which grain of sand in which pile is the Buddha. Obviously, to ask that question is to look in the wrong direction, for the Buddha is everywhere. But just as obviously to ask that question is to look in the right direction, for the Buddha is everywhere. About the Buddha that exists independently of any analytic thought, much has been said. Some would say too much, and would question any attempt to add to it. But about the Buddha that exists within analytic thought, and gives that analytic thought its direction, virtually nothing has been said. And there are historic reasons for this. But history keeps happening, and it seems no harm, and maybe some positive good, to add to our historical heritage with some talk in this area of discourse. When analytic thought, the knife, is applied to experience, something is always killed in the process. That is fairly well understood, at least in the arts. Mark Twain's experience comes to mind, in which, after he had mastered the analytic knowledge needed to pilot the Mississippi River, he discovered the river had lost its beauty. Something is always killed. But what is less noticed in the arts, something is always created, too. And instead of just dwelling on what is killed, it's important also to see what's created and to see the process as a kind of death-birth continuity that is neither good nor bad, but just is. We pass through a town called Marmouth, but John doesn't stop even for a rest, and so we go on. More furnace heat, into some badlands, and we cross the border into Montana. A sign by the road announces it. Sylvia waves her arms up and down, and I beep the horn in response, but when I look at the sign, my feelings are not jubilant at all. For me, its information causes a sudden inward tension that can't exist for them. They've no way of knowing we're now in the country where he lived. All this talk so far about classic and romantic understanding must seem a strangely oblique way of describing him. But to get at Phaedrus, this oblique route is the only one to take. To describe his physical appearance, or the statistics of his life, would be to dwell on misleading superficialities. And to come at him directly would be to invite disaster. He was insane. And when you look directly at an insane man, all you see is a reflection of your own knowledge that he's insane, which is not to see him at all. To see him, you must see what he saw, and when you are trying to see the vision of an insane man, an oblique route is the only way to come at it. Otherwise, your own opinions block the way. There is only one access to him that I can see as passable, and we still have a way to go. I've been going into all this business of analyses and definitions and hierarchies, not for their own sake, but to lay the groundwork for an understanding of the direction in which Phaedrus went. I told Chris the other night that Phaedrus spent his entire life pursuing a ghost. That was true. The ghost he pursued was the ghost that underlies all of technology, all of modern science, all of Western thought. It was the ghost of rationality itself. I told Chris that he found the ghost, and that when he found it, he thrashed it good. I think in a figurative sense, that is true. The things I hope to bring to light as we go along are some of the things he uncovered. Now the times are such that others may at last find them of value. No one then would see the ghost that Phaedrus pursued, but I think now that more and more people see it, or get glimpses of it in bad moments, a ghost which calls itself rationality, but whose appearance is that of incoherence and meaninglessness, which causes the most normal of everyday acts to seem slightly mad because of their irrelevance to anything else. This is the ghost of normal everyday assumptions, which declares that the ultimate purpose of life, which is to keep alive, is impossible, but that this is the ultimate purpose of life anyway. So that great minds struggle to cure diseases so that people may live longer, but only madmen ask why. One lives longer in order that he may live longer. There is no other purpose. That is what the ghost says. At Baker, where we stop, the thermometers are reading 108 degrees in the shade. When I take my gloves off, the metal of the gas tank is so hot I can't touch it. The engine is making ominous knick-knicking sounds from overheating. Very bad. The rear tire has worn badly, too, and I feel with my hand that it's almost as hot as the gas tank. We're going to have to slow down, I say. What? I don't think we should go over 50, I say. John looks at Sylvia, and she looks at him. Something has already been said between them about my slowness. They both look as if they've about had it. We just want to get there fast, John says, and they both walk toward a restaurant. The chain has been running hot and dry, too. In the right-hand saddlebag, I rummage for a can of spray lubricant, find it, then start the engine and spray the moving chain. The chain is still so hot the solvent evaporates almost instantly. Then I squirt a little oil on, let it run for a minute, and shut the engine off. Chris waits patiently, then follows me into the restaurant. I thought you said the big slump was going to come on the second day, Sylvia says as we approach the booth they are in. Second or third, I reply. Or fourth or fifth? Maybe. She and John look at each other again with the same expression they showed before. It seems to say three's a crowd. They want to go ahead fast and wait for me in some town up ahead. I'd suggest it myself, except that if they go much faster, they won't be waiting for me in some town. It'll be the side of the road.
I don't know how the people here stand this, Sylvia says.
Well, it's hard country, I say, with a little irritation. They know it's hard before they come here, and are ready for it. I add, if one person complains, he just makes it that much harder for the others. They've got stamina. They know how to keep on going. John and Sylvia don't say much, and John finishes his Coke early and is off to a bar for a snort. I go out and check the cycle luggage again and find that the new pack has been compressing a little, and so take up the slack in the ropes and retie them. Chris points to a thermometer in direct sunlight, and we see it has gone all the way above the scale at 120 degrees. Before we are out of town, I am sweating again. The cool drying-off period doesn't last even half a minute. The heat just slams into us. Even with dark sunglasses, I have to squint my eyes into slits. There's nothing but burning sand and pale sky so bright it's hard to look anywhere. It's just become white-hot everywhere, a real inferno. John up ahead is speeding faster and faster. I give up on him and slow it down to 55. Unless you're just looking for trouble in this heat, you don't run tires at 85. A blowout on this stretch would really be it. I suppose they took what I said as a kind of rebuke, but I didn't have that in mind. I'm no more comfortable than they are in this heat, but there's no point in dwelling on it. All day, while I've been thinking and talking about Phaedrus, they must have been thinking about how bad all this is. That's what's really wearing them down. The thought. Some things can be said about Phaedrus as an individual. He was a knower of logic, the classical system of the system which describes the rules and procedures of systematic thought, by which analytic knowledge may be structured and interrelated. He was so swift at this, his Stanford Binet IQ, which is essentially a record of skill at analytic manipulation, was recorded at 170, a figure that occurs in only one person in 50,000. He was systematic, but to say he thought and acted like a machine would be to misunderstand the nature of his thought. It was not like pistons and wheels and gears all moving at once, massive and coordinated. The image of a laser beam comes to mind instead. A single pencil of light of such terrific energy and such extreme concentration it can be shot at the moon, and its reflection seen back on Earth. Phaedrus did not try to use his brilliance for general illumination. He sought one specific distant target, and aimed for it, and hit it. And that was all. General illumination of that target he hit now seems to be left for me. In proportion to his intelligence, he was extremely isolated. There's no record of his having had close friends. He traveled alone, always. Even in the presence of others, he was completely alone. People sometimes felt this and felt rejected by it, and so did not like him. But their dislike was not important to him. His wife and family seemed to have suffered the most. His wife says those who tried to go beyond the barriers of his reserve found themselves facing a blank. My impression is that they were starved for some kind of affection, which he never gave. No one really knew him. That is evidently the way he wanted it, and that's the way it was. Perhaps his aloneness was the result of his intelligence. Perhaps it was the cause. But the two were always together. An uncanny, solitary intelligence. This still doesn't do it, though, because this, and the image of a laser beam, convey the idea that he was completely cold and unemotional, and that is not so. In his pursuit of what I have called the ghost of rationality, he was a fanatic hunter. One fragment becomes especially vivid now, of a scene in the mountains where the sun was behind the mountain half an hour, and an early twilight had changed the trees and even the rocks to almost blackened shades of blue and gray and brown. Phaedrus had been there 3 days without food. His food had run out, but he was thinking deeply and seeing things, and was reluctant to leave. He was not far away from where he knew there was a road, and was in no hurry. In the dusk, coming down the trail, he saw movement, and then what seemed to be a dog approaching on the trail, a very large sheepdog, or an animal more like a husky, and he wondered what would bring a dog to this obscure place at this time of evening. He disliked dogs, but this animal moved in a way that forestalled these feelings. It seemed to be watching him, judging him.
Phaedrus stared into the animal's eyes for a long time, and for a moment felt some kind of recognition.
Then the dog disappeared. He realized much later it was a timber wolf, and the memory of this incident stayed with him a long time.
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 3, Side 1. He realized much later it was a timber wolf, and the memory of this incident stayed with him a long time. I think it stayed with him because he had seen a kind of image of himself. A photograph can show a physical image in which time is static, and a mirror can show a physical image in which time is dynamic. But I think what he saw on the mountain was another kind of image altogether, which was not physical and did not exist in time at all. It was an image, nevertheless, and that is why he felt recognition. It comes to me vividly now because I saw it again last night as the visage of Phaedrus himself. Like that timber wolf on the mountain, he had a kind of animal courage. He went his own way with unconcern for consequences that sometimes stunned people, and stuns me now to hear about it. He did not often swerve to right or to left. I've discovered that. But this courage didn't arise from any idealistic idea of self-sacrifice, only from the intensity of his pursuit, and there was nothing noble about it. I think his pursuit of the ghost of rationality occurred because he wanted to wreak revenge on it, because he felt he himself was so shaped by it. He wanted to free himself from his own image. He wanted to destroy it because the ghost was what he was, and he wanted to be free from the bondage of his own identity. In a strange way, this freedom was achieved. This account of him must sound unworldly, but the most unworldly part of it is all yet to come. This is my own relationship to him. This has been forestalled and obscured until now, but nevertheless must be known. I first discovered him by inference from a strange series of events many years ago. One Friday I had gone to work and gotten quite a lot done before the weekend and was happy about that, and later that day drove to a party where, after talking to everybody too long and too loudly and drinking way too much, went into a back room to lie down for a while. When I awoke, I saw that I'd slept the whole night, because now it was daylight, and I thought, my God, I didn't even know the name of the hosts, and wondered what kind of embarrassment this was going to lead to. The room didn't look like the room I'd lain down in,
but it had been dark when I came in, and I must have been blind drunk anyway. I got up and saw that my clothes were changed. These were not the clothes I had worn the night before. I walked out the door, but to my surprise, the doorway led not to rooms of a house, but into a long corridor. As I walked down the corridor, I got the impression that everyone was looking at me. 3 different times a stranger stopped me and asked how I felt. Thinking they were referring to my drunken condition, I replied that I didn't even have a hangover, which caused one of them to start to laugh, but then catch himself. At a room at the end of the corridor, I saw a table where there was activity of some sort going on. I sat down nearby, hoping to remain unnoticed until I got all this figured out. But a woman dressed in white came up to me and asked if I knew her name. I read the little name clip on her blouse. She didn't see that I was doing this, and seemed amazed, and walked off in a hurry. When she came back, there was a man with her, and he was looking right at me. He sat down next to me and asked me if I knew his name. I told him what it was, and was as surprised as they were that I knew it. "It's very early for this to be happening," he said. "This looks like a hospital," I said. They agreed. "How did I get here?" I asked, thinking about the drunken party. The man said nothing, and the woman looked down. Very little was explained. It took me more than a week to deduce from the evidence around me that everything before my waking up was a dream, and everything afterward was reality. There was no basis for distinguishing the two, other than the growing pile of new events that seemed to argue against the drunk experience. Little things appeared, like the locked door, the outside of which I could never remember seeing, and a slip of paper from the probate court telling me that some person was committed as insane. Did they mean me? It was explained to me finally that you have a new personality now. But this statement was no explanation at all. It puzzled me more than ever, since I had no awareness at all of any old personality. If they had said, "You are a new personality," it would have been much clearer. That would have fitted. They had made the mistake of thinking of a personality as some sort of possession, like a suit of clothes which a person wears. But apart from a personality, what is there? Some bones and flesh? A collection of legal statistics, perhaps, but surely no person. The bones and flesh and legal statistics are the garments worn by the personality, not the other way around. But who was the old personality whom they had known and presumed I was a continuation of? This was my first inkling of the existence of Phaedrus, many years ago. In the days and weeks and years that have followed, I've learned much more. He was dead, destroyed by order of the court, enforced by the transmission of high-voltage alternating current through the lobes of his brain. Approximately 800 mils of amperage at durations of 0.5 to 1.5 seconds had been applied on 28 consecutive occasions in a process known technologically as annihilation ECS. A whole personality had been liquidated without a trace in a technologically faultless act that has defined our relationship ever since. I have never met him, never will. And yet strange wisps of his memory suddenly match and fit this road and desert bluffs and white-hot sand all around us, and there is a bizarre concurrence, and then I know he has seen all of this. He was here, otherwise I would not know it. He had to be. And in these sudden coalescences of vision, and in recall of some strange fragment of thought whose origin I have no idea of, I'm not a clairvoyant, a spirit medium receiving messages from another world. That is how it is. I see things with my own eyes, and I see things with his eyes, too. He once owned them. These eyes. That is the terror of it. These gloved hands I now look at, steering the motorcycle down the road, were once his. And if you can understand the feeling that comes from that, then you can understand real fear. The fear that comes from knowing there is nowhere you can possibly run. We enter a low-rimmed canyon. Before long, a roadside stop I've been waiting for appears. A few benches, a little building, and some tiny green trees with hoses running to their bases. John, so help me God, is at the exit on the other side, ready to pull out onto the highway. I ignore this and pull up by the building. Chris jumps off, and we pull the machine back up on the stand. The heat rises from the engine as if it were on fire, throwing off waves that distort everything around it. Out of the corner of